This season of Invisible Capital is presented by Sapphire Ventures, a leading global B2B software-focused venture capital firm partnering with visionary teams building companies of consequence. As enterprise software specialists, Sapphire knows the challenges that high-growth B2B companies face when scaling from expansion stage to IPO. Sapphire partner and revenue excellence leader Curran Singh specializes in helping companies architect an efficient revenue engine that unlocks their ability to scale effectively. Stay tuned after today's episode to listen to the Sapphire series Game Changers, a show where Curran dives deep with the best revenue leaders in the industry on how they've transformed their company's growth trajectories. Head to sapphireventures.com to learn more about Sapphire's team of investors, portfolio growth advisors, and investment strategies, plus best practices and resources available from B2B industry experts.
I mean, there's lots of businesses out there that are wonderful debt investments and terrible equity investments if they just carry on the equity trajectory that they were on. So in some of those cases, yeah, debt's been sort of a lifeline for them. And I think if you take the view that, oh, this is really dangerous, we shouldn't do this, maybe it's just kicking the can down the road. You know, time changes a lot of things. I'm not suggesting you take on debt without a plan, but in the cases where it's been successful, there's been a plan and it has sort of helped companies.
Hello and welcome to Invisible Capital, a podcast on the private markets. I'm Alexander Davis, Editor-in-Chief of PitchBook News. And in today's episode, you'll hear PitchBook financial writer Marina Temkin interviewing John Markle, managing partner of Armentum Partners, about the landscape for venture debt financed deals. But before we get into that segment, this is the sixth and final installment for our VC-focused season of this podcast. With that in mind, and as we approach the holiday season, it's a fitting time to gain a bit of perspective on the 2022 year in the VC ecosystem in what's been an extraordinary time. To help us assess what has made this a pivotal period of change in the markets, I've invited, or should I say I've assigned, some of my newsroom colleagues to join us today. We've got Marina, our financial writer who covers the venture market with me here in San Francisco. And we're joined by senior editor James Thorne. Marina, James, great to speak with you today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Alec.
So guys, this has been a year that will certainly be remembered as a turning point, or at least a really exceptional year, simply by virtue of the overall market climate being so starkly different or bearish after so many years of seeing our data charts go up and to the right. Instead of trying to take it all in, I thought we'd take turns just singling out a particular market event or trend from this year that you've covered in recent months, something that really helps define just how tumultuous and unusual of a year that this has been. So, Marina, start us out. Which trend or topic stands out for you in this way that you've been working on lately?
Yeah, I think the biggest topic of the year is what's been going on with valuation and venture capital deals. It all started really end of last year when the stock market plunged while venture capital deals prices were getting higher and higher. And very, very late of last year, some VCs told me that they feel it, that it's really getting out of hand. And they're actually looking forward to prices to come down and the market to cool down. And they may have gotten their wish, maybe even more so than they wanted to, because obviously VC market has slowed down significantly as the stock market kept falling lower and lower. And what we're seeing now is that especially for late stage, the deal prices have fallen quite significantly for new deals. We just had a report published by in the venture capital monitor and valuation team. They published a report that says that from Q1 to Q3, late stage deal prices fell almost 30%. the biggest question, of course, is what's going on with existing companies that were getting funded last year, because obviously the problem for them is that they were valued way ahead of where the market would value them now. So luckily for them, a lot of companies have a lot of cash. They've raised significant funding amounts last year, but at some point they're going to run out of this cash and they're going to have to come back to their investors and ask for more capital. An investor is going to tell them, well, unfortunately, we cannot fund you at the same levels that we funded you last year, the previous year in 2021. So they're going to have to do something. They're going to have to grow into those valuations. And that's a tall challenge for many of them.
So let me just jump in for a second there on one of your point about that many VCs actually wished for some of this. And it seems to me that like you could also say this is a careful what you wish for scenario. But on the other hand, it does seem like this is something that a lot of investors wanted to see. They might have even encouraged it so that they could take a pause, deal with what many people across the market saw as an inflationary time. I mean, a bubble in the private markets. And I'm just wondering, would you agree that there was actually some active encouragement of this and like almost looking for an excuse to, write smaller checks and maybe even fewer of them?
Yeah, I think that's a skeptic's view. And there may be a little bit of that. And obviously, I think some VCs are using this as an opportunity to pay lower prices for companies. But I think a lot of it is really driven by the public markets. Because right now, obviously, companies cannot exit at the same levels that they were exiting at last year. So investors, what they do is they look back saying, if we, say, invest in a company at Series C, where would it exit, say, 2 years from now or a year from now if it's a later stage company? And they're seeing a huge disconnect between the private market valuation and the public market valuation. And they're also looking at comparables. They're saying, look, your closest comparable in the public market is trading at 6x revenue. And your last round, you were valued at, depending on the round, but it could be as big as, 100x revenue. Obviously, that's for earlier stage. So they have to, there has to be some matching between public markets and private markets. Although private markets could be, valuations for private markets could be higher than public markets. It's just that the discrepancy right now is so huge, it's just impossible to get on the same page.
All right, let's give James a chance now to weigh in with what for him stands out about the year.
Yeah, I think for me, the story of the year is really crypto. And I think this week, we got a really good glimpse into how things have changed there. I mean, at the beginning of this year, FTX was raising money at a $32 billion valuation. Now they might be worth nothing. That's obviously an extreme example, but there have been several collapses in the crypto industry. Clearly a lack of oversight, a lack of responsible governance at a lot of these companies. And the fact that it's happening to FTX is, it's hard to overstate what a big deal this is, because FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, the CEO, it was really seen as, our PitchBook analyst Robert Lee, who covers crypto, referred to it as a blue chip exchange. This company had the ear of Washington. They were backed by Sequoia, Tiger Global, SoftBank. They were really seen as the premier crop of crypto companies. And to see them fail in this manner, it's still not clear exactly what caused this to happen and for it to happen so abruptly. But it really is a really dark mark on the whole crypto industry, on all the VCs that had rushed into this sector. I think it's going to have repercussions that extend well into next year, if not longer.
James, how much of it is because it's saying something about the way that this asset class is regulated versus, the possibility that, and we'll have to see how it turns out, but it's also possible that this is less about crypto per se and just one company moving around money in a irresponsible way, that where they just, you know, took funds that weren't supposed to be lent to this this unit of theirs, Alameda Trading.
Yeah, I think it certainly is a story about one company, but I think it's impossible, especially in the eyes of regulators, to divorce it from the story of the whole industry. You know, as you know, crypto industry has been in a years-long effort to get favorable regulations. Sam Bankman-Fried was testifying before Congress not that long ago. He and others have wanted the industry to be regulated by the CFTC rather than the SEC. I think this really puts the industry on a back foot. Obviously, I don't think Sam Bankman-Fried is going to be the person to lead those kind of talks going forward, given what's happened. But for others who are in a similar position of prominence, it's going to make their job of convincing regulators not to treat them like banks. It's going to make that job a lot harder. There's going to be a lot more scrutiny over, I think, also just from investors who, you know, really didn't do their job here very well. You know, it's hard to say if there had been better oversight of FTX, whether this had been avoided. But I think it's pretty clear that investors didn't really make much of an effort to put in place good oversight at FTX for even basic things like, you know, making sure that they weren't exposed to a liquidity crunch in the event of large amounts of withdrawals. Sam Bankman-Fried went on Twitter and basically said, you know, I was looking at our numbers wrong. I didn't understand, you know, what a bad position we were in. And that's a really bad look. Sequoia published a letter to their LPs online. They marked this investment down to zero. They said that they had run rigorous due diligence on FTX, but I think, you know, that's a really hard thing for the public to believe. It's a really hard thing, I think, for regulators to believe that these companies actually do have investors who are providing diligence. When this kind of event happens, a large – keep in mind, this is one of the top three exchanges in the world, and it collapsed within a couple of days.
Yeah, and what about Binance? You know, Binance would appear to be the kind of leader now, undisputed, and they were on the verge of taking over, rescuing FTX, and now they're not doing that. Where does that leave them? Do you guys think that they now are at risk in this in the dust before it settles?
I think there's two schools of thought right now that are sort of battling it out online. You know, a lot of people earlier in the year expected there to be a lot of consolidation in the crypto industry. Many argued that that was going to be a good thing. This is not a good thing for anyone. The CEO of Binance, he goes by the nickname CZ, told employees that, quote, FTX going down is not good for anyone in the industry. Do not view it as a win for us. I think that the likely outcome is that this, again, just shakes the faith of users, of investors, of regulators in the industry overall. Obviously, has a very negative impact on crypto prices, as we've seen in the past week. I don't think that there will be a direct impact on Binance, certainly. If there will be, we haven't seen it yet, as far as anything negative, any kind of negative fallout. But certainly would not view this as a positive for them or for any other company in the crypto exchange world.
James, what do you think this means for crypto venture capital funds? Because there have been a few of them, a lot of them actually raised, and they've raised quite big capital pools.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of money that's been flooding into this industry. You can't really talk about it without talking about Andreessen Horowitz and Chris Dixon, who's led their push into this sector. I think they have something like 80 or 90 people working in the crypto sector at Andreessen Horowitz right now. You know, obviously with those kind of resources allocated to the space, they have to be confident that this is going somewhere positive long term. I don't think that FTX going down will totally reverse that, but I think they're going to want to take a real close look at their portfolio companies, take a close look at how growth and returns are coming in over the next year and a half, probably before they decide to go out and raise another fund. I'm sure LPs are going to want to see the proof in the pudding there. You know, they had a really, really good bet on Coinbase. It paid off in a huge way. So they have a great story going into this. I think for a lot of other crypto VCs, you know, their LPs are going to want to take a closer look at some of the fund returns, that the paper returns that they've been reporting, to see, you know, how much of that is real and durable. Because I think an event like what has happened to FTX is going to reset the expectations for all future valuations in this space.
So I just want to take my turn, talk about one topic that I thought was emblematic of what's been going on in this turning point. And that actually also goes back to last year. So I'm cheating a little bit here. But I think back to when the SPAC mania was going crazy, and then it started to die down, and it died down quickly. And there were some real interesting blow-ups and stumbles in that particular corner of the market. To me, that signaled a kind of change in the atmosphere, and it spoke to this notion that the private markets are getting more and more limited in finding liquidity and finding opportunities to really, you know, offload their investments to people. I'm curious what your takes are on that. And whether, you know, you see that kind of theme carrying over into this phase that we're in right now.
Yeah, I think before we see investor confidence return, you know, we do have to see some of those big exits, and it's really hard in this environment to predict that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm closely watching what's going on with mergers and acquisitions, because I think that's truly the only avenue right now. And I know a lot of VCs are pushing some of the companies to look for exits that way. There will also likely be some startup to startup consolidation. So I expect next year to have a lot of M&A, although a lot of it won't be amazing returns. It may be something. It's better to return something to LPs than nothing at all, even if it could end up being just one-time capital. I think LPs are very hungry to have cash flowing back to them.
Yeah, and Marina, you have your finger on the pulse of what's going on among LPs. You write about LPs' relations with GPs, GPs raising funds with LPs, and you've written some stories about the changing fundraising environment. The VC funds have still been able to raise quite a bit of capital, but things are changing. Can you talk about what kinds of main changes you're seeing and what that says about LPs changing expectations?
Yeah, I think this year everybody was surprised just how much capital was raised by venture capital funds. And from what I understand, a lot of it is a result of how hot the market was last year. There was a lot of deal making. VCs were saying that they're seeing a lot of great opportunities. They were deploying capital quickly, and they ran out of funds a lot faster than they expected. So they went back to their LPs and said, we want to raise a fund, a bigger fund, much sooner than we expected. And I mean, in some cases, it was like 6 months sooner. But nevertheless, they started fundraising late last year. And a lot of those funds were closed and announced this year. So it looks like it was just an incredible year for fundraising. What's happening now is really the reverse, because deployment pace has been so slow this year. A lot of the VCs are still sitting on that committed capital. And until they start deploying it at a kind of a more moderate pace, they won't be coming back to their LPs and raising new funds. So right now, LPs are telling me that there is a slowdown. So funds that were planning to come back to market, say, early 2023 are pushing their fundraising to the end of 2023, and it may end up being even the following year. So I think this is all very healthy and good for the ecosystem not to have fundraising happen so quickly, and it's just such a bigger space.
All right, guys. Well, it has indeed been an extraordinary and tumultuous year. We'll see how it carries over into the new year and how much of this we'll still be talking about in 2023. So that was Marina Temkin and James Thorne. Thanks for joining us. And for links to more PitchBook news and analysis, visit pitchbook.com/podcast. After the break, we'll hear Marina's conversation with John Markle of Armentum Partners.
Stay tuned after today's interview to hear the latest episode of Sapphire Ventures series Game Changers, where Sapphire partner and head of revenue excellence Curran Singh connects with the best revenue leaders in the industry about how they've transformed their company's growth trajectories.
Give some counsel to our audience. Assume that there's revenue leaders listening in and saying, hey, I want to go down this journey. How did you pitch this to your leadership in Forter and in past lives? What would you suggest they do as part of their pitch as well to cement this concept in their leadership's mind and get buy-in?
Admittedly, I think this is the most important sale a revenue leader will make, is the internal sale. I think there is a propensity for founders and early stage companies to underinvest and go to market, thinking that, hey, if my product is super legit, it'll sell itself, or the phone will just ring because this stuff is so amazing, and we'll just hire some rainmaker, natural all-star salespeople, and they can will their way to victory. It's a dangerous path to go down.
Chris had started on the healthcare side. I started on the tech side. The market's changed a lot, is the short answer. I guess part of this interview is to talk about how, but probably the most obvious thing to us is just...
Hi, John. Welcome to Invisible Capital Podcast. Today, we're going to be discussing venture debt. So could you please introduce yourself, your firm, Armentum, and what role you play in the venture debt universe?
Thanks, Marina. My name is John Markle. I'm a managing partner at Armentum Partners. The role we play in the venture debt universe is we are advisors to technology and healthcare companies that are looking to raise venture debt as part of their capital raising strategies. So we help them raise the debt they want at terms that are optimized for their needs.
How long have you been around, and how has venture debt landscape changed over those years?
We as a firm have been around for a little over, I want to say in earnest, about 11 years. Chris Carthy and I started the firm. Chris had started on the healthcare side. I started on the tech side. The market's changed a lot, is the short answer. I guess part of this interview is to talk about how, but probably the most obvious thing to us is just awareness that venture debt is a funding tool for companies that they hadn't previously thought. And under the awareness category, I think companies have a better understanding of that it's not just, oh my gosh, they're going to take the keys to the company, that it's actually quite a friendly funding tool.
I understand that there's been a lot new players that have entered the market over those years. Why are there new entrants into venture debt?
This is where I could take one of two tacks. One is because we've been doing our job and we're sort of yelling from the rooftops the value of the asset class. That's probably a tiny little part. But in reality, I believe it's because venture debt as an asset class under the category of private credit is really attractive from a risk reward perspective. And I think even to this day, it's not intuitive to a lot of the new entrants. I think because the word venture is associated with it, and because it's so closely tied to venture capital, where they read article after article about how venture capital firms make their funds on 1, 2, 3 investments out of 20, there's this perhaps incorrect leap or assumption that, well, venture debt must be, you know, almost as risky. That's simply not the case. I think the data has shown that it's actually quite a safe asset class. Loss rates, certainly for, I'm going to say, sort of the most active 30 venture debt lenders, are below mid-market cash flow lending loss rates, and the returns are higher. So some of the larger credit funds look at this and go, gee, why aren't we in this?
I also understand that part of the reason there have been a lot more interest in asset class, other than that it turned out to be a rather safe, surprisingly safe, and surprisingly lucrative asset class, is that the sizes of loans have increased tremendously over the years. Did that happen kind of in line with the venture universe growing, or is there something else at play? Are startups more open to taking on more debt? And is that usually happen? Does that usually happen with the blessing of their venture capitalists?
So there's a lot to address there and unpack. I think one of the overarching drivers of loan sizes and just venture debt volumes increasing has happened because it's piggybacked off of just private credit generally increasing. If you look at private credit today versus 10 years ago, it's like 7 or 8x or even more. I don't even know the data. It's crazy. I just know that it's straight up. That's one factor. The other factor is the venture debt product or products have evolved to better suit the various borrowers of those products. So when we started in this business like a little over a decade ago, you know, I used to use the analogy that each lender's widget was their term sheet. You know, they'd sell, like Apple sells this, you know, this is what they sell, and they sell a phone. Well, a lender sells a term sheet, and that term sheet by and large looks kind of the same for most deals. They tweak it on the edges, but years ago, the term sheet that you'd get from pick a lender, Hercules, TriplePoint, WTI, whatever, it kind of looked the same for an e-commerce company as it did for an ad tech company, as it did for an enterprise software company. So as the market evolved, new entrants came in, those loan products also evolved to fit the need, the use case, the need, the risk. So I think that was happening on the product side. On the, call it ecosystem side, you had more and more venture capital firms, like the investors of these portfolio companies, getting a lot more comfortable with venture lenders. They were realizing that, hey, these lenders aren't just going to say, give me the keys to the company. They really don't have any interest in owning the company. And I think most venture debt lenders will identify themselves as relationship lenders. So it's this approach that I think the venture debt firms have taken with those investors to say, hey, we have a problem. Let's, you know, what can we do to fix it? As opposed to consulting the loan and security agreement saying, this is what we must do here because it says we need to do this here. So there was a lot more, I'm going to call it relationship furtherance between venture debt lender and venture capital investor broadly in the market, such that, okay, maybe we can put a little bit more leverage on the company. Maybe we can put a little bit more leverage on the company. We still believe in many cases, companies are safely levered because of this phenomena, if you want to call it a phenomena. But I think that's a big part of why borrowers are borrowing more or why they're able to borrow more, because the product has evolved to fit the situation a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. So broadly speaking, how do venture lenders make decisions about creditworthiness of a startup? Because all the startups, for the most part, are cash flow negative. In traditional lending, you're either lending against assets of the company or cash flows of the company. And in, for most part, startups don't have either of those.
Right. Well, yeah. So the way we sort of simply view the lending world is there are three types of loans. But like you mentioned, two of them you mentioned, there's cash flow loans, which the underwriting is predicated on the lender's view that the company will have enough cash flow to sustain and then ultimately repay the loan. Asset-based lending, where the underwriting is based on assuming that an orderly liquidation of the assets exceeds, like the value that's received from that exceeds the value of the loan. And then the third type is mostly where we spend our time, and which is how venture debt's defined. It's what's called enterprise value lending. So enterprise value lending isn't quite as neatly defined the way the other types of lending are. With enterprise value lending, lenders are generally looking for not just an underwriting anchor to get comfortable with, but perhaps a couple things that together constitute an underwriting anchor. So the best proxy is, well, what was the last valuation? And they, you know, they make an assumption and they do underwriting and question around, okay, if you had to sell this business quickly, what would that look like? Who could you sell it to? How fast could you sell it? Why would they be buying you? That sort of stuff. Another analysis that might be done is, okay, we can't sell the business just yet. It doesn't make sense. What does it look like if you turn off R&D and if you turn off sales and marketing? Do you have contracts? Do you have something where you can increase margins without the view that you're going to perpetuate the business, but rather run off the business? What does that look like? The other thing is, you know, does the IP have value? And not so much in the context of, does it have value where we can offensively enforce any infringers, but rather, you know, is this IP worth something to someone else if they were to acquire it? You know, that's, IP is sort of a weird thing in that there's no defined value for it. It's worth as much as someone's willing to pay for it. Those are just some examples of how lenders will get comfortable doing enterprise value lending. I should probably note, like, that type of analysis varies depending on stage. So, you know, when we're talking to clients who haven't done this before or done it a few times, a venture debt loan being underwritten for a company that's sort of, you know, call it Series E or pre-IPO is going to be very, the underwriting is going to be very different than like a Series A. We always say it's sort of a two-pronged approach where one prong is the lenders going through and trying to ascertain the inherent creditworthiness of the business itself. The other prong is, okay, who's in the equity syndicate? What was their underwriting thesis? Is there more capital from this equity syndicate? So in other words, they're assessing future financing risk from the parties already involved in the business. And they ascribe value to that. A Series A company, they're going to ascribe a lot of value to that latter prong. A Series E type company, they're going to ascribe much less value to that latter prong and more value to the inherent creditworthiness of the business. So it kind of shifts over time.
Mm-hmm. From what I understand is that historically venture debt, and correct me if I'm wrong, this was more on the early stage side, historically it followed a venture equity round. But this year, kind of there's been a downturn in the public markets, and venture capitalists retreated, and they're much more reluctant to fund startups, partially because of valuation having fallen. So a lot of startups have turned to venture debt to extend their runway. But at the same time, those financings are not done following a venture equity round. How has that changed? Like, what are the considerations for lenders in this current market?
I wouldn't say it's actually changed so much as the timing that they follow has changed a little bit. So you're right. Historically, most, especially on the healthcare side, most venture debt deals were done on the heels of an equity raise. You had a fresh valuation, you had a healthy balance sheet, and the adage of it's best to get a line of credit in place when you don't need one, you know, that followed so that it would underwrite that way. But as the market evolved, as both borrowers and their investors got more comfortable taking on debt, and venture debt lenders got more savvy in terms of how to structure their product to match the risk and use case, the time between or time after that last equity round to the next equity round, or any, if there's no equity round, has changed. And a big part of that is, I think lenders are looking a little bit more on what's the money going to be used for, what's the risk. And, you know, we always tell clients, venture debt is great if the money's going to be used to do more of the same thing that you're already doing. In other words, it's great for like sales and marketing risk in markets that you already know and that you have data for. It's terrible for R&D. It's terrible for product risk or R&D risk. It's terrible for just pure cash burn to pay senior management. So it's really a question of, you know, what is debt capital best used for from a risk assessment perspective? So that's helped. I think one of the things that's sort of prompting this question, I mean, I'm not in your head, but I think one of the things that's prompting the question now is you're hearing about venture debt a lot more often. In this particular market, and in, I'm going to say, sort of downturns in the past, so think, you know, early to mid 2020, early 2016, middle of 2014, where there have been periods where equity valuations have sort of gyrated a little bit and there's been uncertainty as to, hey, what's equity funding going to look like? The sort of, by extension, indirect extension, is a lot of the businesses that are well funded, they basically sort of size up their market and go, okay, in periods when funding is going to be tight, there's going to be haves and have nots, right? There's going to be a broader divide between the quality of companies within that domain. So I think what you're seeing now is a very is a gap that's widening rapidly. And a lot of those businesses that are well capitalized, either because they just raised a round, or maybe they raised a whole bunch in 2021 and just happened to time things right and just happened to focus more on margin right. And in other words, they have a healthy balance sheet today. However it got there, so be it, but they have a healthy balance sheet today. A lot of the debt that's being raised today is around, hey, we think we're one of the healthier in our sectors. We want to be opportunistic and either raise money to be opportunistic to do M&A, to raise money to M&A where we have stuff already lined up, or, and there's a very high correlation between the healthier and, or we're just really prudent. And if we can raise money today, we're going to because we can. And as you can imagine, the high prudence and health are probably strongly correlated. So we're seeing a lot of that today. So it's not necessarily following, you know, a very near venture capital round. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. A follow-up question is that I understand from a lot of VCs is that they've said that venture debt has saved the day for many of their portfolio companies, meaning that some of the portfolio companies had, you know, maybe, you know, less than a year of runway left, and they went out and raised venture debt, and now they've have, you know, I don't know, 18 months or 2 years, something that VCs have been advising in this downturn. Do you think some of the companies that raised debt recently are at a higher risk of default? Because I also know that there is kind of a cohort of VCs that are saying venture debt is not the best product for certain companies.
So I'm an engineer with a math degree. Is raising debt now higher risk than before? No, because the cost of capital has gone up across the board, and it's a risk-adjusted cost of capital perspective. So yes, interest rates have risen, spreads have risen, but if on a sort of risk-adjusted basis from a math perspective, no, risk hasn't increased. From a qualitative aspect, in terms of is now the right time to raise debt and all that, I can't answer that question. I'm not sure any VC is able to ascertain that question in general. With specific companies, of course, you know, they have the expertise of what their companies are doing. So I think it's very hard to just say across the board, now is not a good time for companies to be raising venture debt. The way we see it, let me focus on the words you used there, which was some folks have said venture debt has saved their companies. So let's look at the extreme cases. We don't actually advise on many of the extreme cases. And by extreme case, I mean something where the company's balance sheet has, you know, 12 months of runway or less or something, and the equity syndicate is tapped out or doesn't want to invest or whatever the reason, the company can't raise equity from insiders. So the company basically has three options, right? One, they can go to outside equity. They're going to take a down round. It's going to hurt. Our experience has been that most insiders will fight that as much as possible unless they've written off the business. And the reason I say our experience is that's usually when we get a call from insiders. So that's one option. They can do that, take punitive equity. The second option is they can raise debt and hope that that capital allows them to live to fight another day. And the third option is they just fold and they try to sell the business or they run out of money or whatever, right? The third option is not really, I mean, that's going to start happening. You know, you're starting to see, or we're starting to hear businesses saying, well, we have an advisor and they're exploring all options. And that's code speak for we're trying to get bought. So we've seen that. But in the second case where the company doesn't really have many options, sure. I mean, there have been some lenders that have said, yeah, we think this is a viable business. It's too bad because of when the rounds were structured that, you know, it was way overvalued, but it could still be a very good debt investment. I mean, there's lots of businesses out there that are wonderful debt investments and terrible equity investments if they just carry on the equity trajectory that they were on. So in some of those cases, yeah, debt's been sort of a lifeline for them. And I think if you take the view that, oh, this is really dangerous, we shouldn't do this, maybe it's just kicking the can down the road. You know, time changes a lot of things. I'm not suggesting you take on debt without a plan, but in the cases where it's been successful, there's been a plan and it has sort of helped companies. Now, all that said, very few lenders want their capital to be an explicit alternative to equity. So remember my comment earlier about they don't want it to be cash burn healing. They don't want it to be product or R&D risk or anything like that. A lot of lenders don't see their money as being a good alternative to equity for that. But in every now and again, in some cases, it's a liquidity problem due to a working capital problem, or they need some capital to convert a couple of contracts that are locked in, signed. Again, that comes down to a working capital problem. Those situations are ones where lenders will go, okay, well, we'll dig in and look at this. We think we can do something. What we have seen more often than you'd think intuitively are situations where a company has venture debt already on its books and it's been there for a while and it's with a lender that knows the business really well and the business is struggling for whatever reason, or contracts are coming in, but they're coming in later than they want and they're running out of cash and they need more capital. We've seen situations where the lender's been the one, the existing lender said, we'll put more capital in. We'll be not rescue financing, because that's kind of a defined term, but we'll be that next dollar that sort of bridges you to the sale or bridges you to a more significant equity round where it's an up valuation. We've seen that quite a bit. We actually track that stuff. Like, we track lender behavior, you know, how they act in problem situations, in opportunistic situations, in great situations. Do they proactively say, hey, we're going to improve the terms here and give you more money, stuff like that. We monitor and track all that. So we have seen situations where it has been very helpful to the borrower for existing loans.
So let's talk about pricing in this environment. Interest rates are obviously going up. From what I understand, there may be an increase in risk. I mean, I think that's what I'm hearing you saying, is because obviously, companies are less likely to, you know, have a next round of venture capital, you know, down the line. So how have those two things impacted pricing?
I would actually say those two things have impacted pricing, but not as much as other things have impacted pricing in our observation. Let me just preface this by saying we just, on our pipeline call on Monday, we decided that we're going to run like a formal exercise to see. So our firm sees between 300 and 500 term sheets a year from 250 different lenders. So to say we have a good idea of where the market is an understatement. We're very on top of that stuff. On the healthcare side of the market, we're only now seeing pricing changes, notwithstanding rate hikes. On the tech side of our business, we saw a almost instantaneous jump, like an immediate sort of step function jump in pricing about 2 months ago. Getting to, and what we're running this exercise now to figure out exactly what that pricing jump was. So I don't have data I can stand behind right now on this, but for us, just anecdotally and all the sort of stuff we see, on the tech side of our business, which is probably what most of the audience would be interested in, we're seeing pricing jump between 150 and 300 basis points above rate hikes, like in addition to rate hikes. But we're still collecting the data on that. We think there have been, I'm going to say, three significant contributors to that. And I guess all of it you could ascribe all the way up as risk changing. The first big contributor is a lot of the venture debt funds, mainly the smaller kind of more active funds like Eastward Capital, Hercules, Avenue Capital is not small, but Avenue Capital, Runway Capital. So a lot of these businesses with dedicated funds, they've deployed more capital this year than they expected to, just as part of their regular fundraising cycle. So as we get toward year end, their bar for what they're going to invest in has risen because they've kind of already deployed their quota, so to speak. They've deployed, I'm not using the right terminology, and I certainly am not in those worlds, but we talk with these folks every day. So that's one aspect of it that's brought pricing up. So the bar has risen because there's just less capital from kind of, I'm going to say, the traditional venture debt lenders. The second big contributor has been that a lot of these larger funds, the asset managers, so the Blackstones, the BlackRocks, the AllianceBernsteins, the Apollos, those larger funds where they have dedicated venture lending. I was like, BlackRock's a great example. They have a sort of a dedicated venture debt group that came out of the old, their acquisition of Tannenbaum Capital 4 years ago, I think. Last year, we would do a deal, you know, it might be a $275 million deal. BlackRock would say, oh, we're going to hold, you know, 150 of it or whatever, or 200 of it or something like that. Hold sizes have dropped at some of these, you know, there are a handful of large asset managers who've said, no, our hold sizes are up. We just raised a big fund, like Sixth Street, for example, like, but by and large, a lot of them, Blackstone, like hold sizes have dropped. So there's just simply put, there's less money in the system. There's also less of a push from LPs to deploy capital, to deploy loan cap debt capital than there was a year ago. So there's less urgency. The third thing is consumer right now is a pariah. So we have seen a what seems to us as an irrational pullback from all things consumer e-commerce. So lenders that traditionally or historically would look at e-commerce deals or consumer deals and say, oh, we like that or whatever, they're not looking at them at all. And I'm not saying they're like they've raised the bar. I'm saying it's they're not looking at them at all.
So are you saying that consumer businesses are really considered quite risky? Is there just no...
That's the, you know, actions speak louder than words. That's the action that is telling us that these lenders think is the case. They think they're far more risky. Part of how I'm spending my time now is talking to heads of credit saying, why? Why do you think that? This is sort of a 1 month, 2 month old phenomena that we're like, wait, you're not, you know, you've done a bunch of consumer deals. Why aren't you doing it anymore? Well, no, we're not touching consumer. Well, why not? Well, if I take this to my IC, I'm going to get shot. Well, why are you going to get shot? Because my IC told me no more consumer. Well, why? Well, they just told us no more consumer. That's a discussion we're having a lot.
Who's an IAC?
Pardon me, investment committee, credit committee, mm-hmm. investment committee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're not giving you a direct explanation why they're seeing consumer as a very risky sector.
Yeah, some lenders are. Some lenders are saying, our bar is higher for consumer. Here's why we're overweight in consumer. We're, you know, and there's rational reasons for that. And some are not. Some were just, no, we're not touching it. Not for us. At the risk of sounding salesy, part of our role sort of sitting in between the borrower and the lender is to minimize everyone's time and resource usage. So in some situations where we believe the lender's not going to be competitive or something like that, we don't push for feedback per se or whatever. And in others, we do. We're like, hey, why is this? What's our asset is information, right? So we get all of our information from the market. And in many of these situations, it just has not been the best use of the lender's time to educate me on how their credit committee thinks or whatever, even though we already have kind of an idea in many respects, but how it's turned. So we just haven't pushed. And that's why I say I'm starting to go, okay, maybe we should start pushing a little bit because we think it'll actually help them.
Two questions I have left. One is, how does venture debt differ from structured equity? And are you seeing those two in competition at the moment?
The answer to the second question is sure. Yes, sure. You know, the Arctic Wolf deal, you know, they received, you know, from a lender, here's a convert, structured equity, call it whatever you want. Here's a plain vanilla debt. The borrower took the convert. So yeah, they're in competition. I mean, all capital's always in competition with a client, and they usually sort of have to work through what's best for the company in terms of taking on the capital and what they how they think it's going to convert into higher dollars and better return for the business. That's an ongoing exercise that companies have to do. Your first question, what's the difference between structured equity and debt and venture debt? At the risk of sounding glib or cute, structured equity is just that, it's equity, it's not debt. Now, US GAAP is the only accounting system in the world where certain types of preferred equity that have an accrual and a liquidation preference and like a term on it is not counted as debt, it's counted as equity. So a lot of the structured equity that's being deployed now, whether you know, if it's convertible debt, I think a lot of people get confused and say, oh, well, this is debt. Sure, it's debt for a period of time, but really it's underwritten by the lender investor in the hopes that it'll convert, because that's where all the upside is. So it sort of helps that lender stay high enough on the seniority stack that if they have to hit the company over the head with a hammer, they will. But the expectation is that it'll convert and there'll be more upside. Venture debt is debt. There's the expectation that it'll be repaid at a certain time. And if you look at some of these structures, the structured equity stuff is where the company's awake is quite loose in terms of covenants and stuff. We've seen some like pipes and stuff going into pre-SPACs where it's been brutally punitive and tight. And that's just, don't know what the advisors were doing there, but like we've seen some of that, but that's more off market. So that generally speaking, it's a looser form of capital. With venture debt, especially for the later stage companies where they have options of different types of capital, there's an expectation that the lender's going to run into problems. I mean, approximately 77% of venture debt deals undergo a covenant breach. So a venture debt lender, unlike like a convert lender, is walking into the situation with an expectation that there's going to be a problem and they underwrite accordingly, which I think from a qualitative or underwriting view with a convert is, you know, they have to plan for that. But they certainly don't underwrite with the expectation that there's going to be all kinds of problems. It's a little bit of a different approach.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think we talked about this earlier, structured equity converts, whatever you want to call it, it is quite in vogue right now because you can raise equity without having to look at yourself in the mirror and say, okay, this is what my valuation is today. You can kick that can down the road. It can... oh, well, this is going to convert at 20% of your next material equity financing or at a discount, or it's going to be at a 10% premium to your last round that was more than 3 years ago. Or so it pegs to some future or past valuation without having to say what the company's valued at today. And some companies, they kind of like that. They kind of like, I don't want to have to look at myself in the mirror right now and admit that we're down. And I would think some investors maybe kind of like that too. So like, remember your question earlier about, hey, has debt saved companies in the past? The convert structured equity, it's not a whole lot different. It's kicking the can down the road of something that has to happen, which is what are we worth?
But in venture debt, there isn't a new valuation set either, right?
Not really. I mean, venture debt usually comes with warrants. And those warrants, I mean, market terms for warrants are always... we're going to have warrants at X percent of the loan coverage, and the warrants are going to strike at whatever the more favorable is of the last round or the next round. When they're structuring the deal, there isn't a huge emphasis on valuation for purposes of defining their return, but rather for underwriting. It's more on what do we think this is worth in a liquidation scenario, not in an upside scenario.
Got it. Everyone is talking about how venture debt is booming right now, and it's such a great alternative to venture capital now that venture capitalists have receded. However, what I've noticed is that after a very strong Q2, we have very, very weak Q3 numbers. They're some of the lowest venture debt value and count numbers since mid-2017. How do you explain the decline?
So a couple things. That's kind of consistent with what we're seeing as well. So if you think about stuff that's closing and when things actually get measured, there's a delay. So we always tell clients that from launching a deal, so from the time the client decides we need to go raise venture debt to the time it hits their balance sheet, it's anywhere from 60 to 90 days. You know, and if companies are doing it themselves, excluding bank financing, it's longer than that. So if you put kind of a one quarter lag on when venture debt closes and when you see it and when it gets measured, that tells us that in Q1, companies are like, we need to raise venture debt of 20, right? Of this year, which kind of coincides at the end of Q1, sort of late March is when valuations really started to decline precipitously, right? So the most prudent of companies said, I can raise debt now. I'm going to do that. So there was a flood of what I'll call the highest quality companies coming to market for venture debt. Those deals closed in Q2. It's showing up in your stats. Meanwhile, move forward a quarter, equity valuation going. The next, I don't want to be disparaging, but the next sort of cohort of companies, either by way of optimism, lack of prudence, or function of when they raise their last equity round, says, hey, we should probably raise some debt as well. So they come to market in Q2, right? And they're the ones that they're kind of, I'm going to say, in between, and that they're very financeable. They may not necessarily need the money, but they're asking for it. So those are the ones that kind of hit the market middle of Q2 to late Q2. They're also sort of toward the end of Q2, you also had, I'll call it the third rung of companies saying, holy crap, we need money. Meanwhile, from the lender's perspective, remember when I said a lot of the traditional venture lenders, they've been deploying capital faster than they thought? I mean, we know some lenders that at the end of June said, we're done for the year. We've deployed more capital than we expected. So a number of lenders, so that cohort that you had seen close a bunch in second quarter that decided in first quarter, the lenders have deployed a bunch of capital, right? So by the time the companies that come to market in the second quarter, especially toward the end of the second quarter, early in the third quarter, by the time those companies come to market for traditional venture debt, the lenders have already, like, a lot of capital has been deployed. Their bar is naturally higher, so it's a lot harder to do a deal. Deals are taking longer, so you're seeing less closing. The stuff that is closing is the opportunistic M&A, the companies that have really, really healthy balance sheets and don't need the capital but want to be opportunistic. That stuff's still closing. That stuff's showing up in your stats. That's the stuff that's keeping us busy right now as well. So I think what you're going to find is Q4 is even less, you know, based on what we're seeing. A lot of those originators that I talked about that weren't going to go to their IC task, they've made their bonus for the year, right? So you take something that's consumer or whatever, a little riskier in Q3, hey, do we, or like that sort of went to market Q3 or even now, we're in Q4. There's almost zero incentive for an originator to go, why am I going to take on this deal? I already have my bonus, our quota, like all these different things. Why am I going to do this? Notwithstanding what's happening in the broader market, right? That's like on top of. So we're not surprised by this. What we do think will happen is they'll be an about face in Q1.
And what do you mean by about face? Are lenders are going to come back to market?
Uh-huh. The clock resets, sort of. Happens every year.
This is a normal trajectory, even though this year it may be a little bit more.
Yeah, there definitely is a cyclicality for lenders' urgency to getting deals closed and what they'll look at in their pipeline and what they won't. And it a lot of it is around funds, their fund cycle, if they're BDCs, when quarter's ending, that sort of stuff. So there's definitely exogenous forces that dictate how far down the credit spectrum they're willing to go.
Great. Thank you, John. Thank you for coming on Invisible Capital Podcast.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me.
In the venture debt universe.
Thanks, Marina. My name is John Markle. I'm a managing partner at Armentum Partners. The role we play in the venture debt universe is we are advisors to...
Welcome to our segment of the program that we're calling Game Changers, where we'll explore how the best revenue leaders have transformed their company's growth trajectory. I'm your host, Karan Singh, partner and leader of the Revenue Excellence Function at Sapphire Ventures. Joining me today is Marcus Holm, CRO at Forter, a Cloud 100 company in the fraud protection and prevention space. Marcus, great to have you joining us.
Likewise, Karan. Thanks for having me as part of your debut podcast. It's a distinct pleasure to be with you.
Let's jump right into it, Marcus. We've interacted in past lives. We worked together in the past. And one of the things that I loved about you is you can always just smell and sense when somebody has revenue in their DNA. What was your aha moment?
It's sort of in the DNA, Karan. I was shaped by my environment in childhood, where I was part of a large family of 11 kids. My father was a professional sales trainer, part of Max Sachs International, doing track selling. So it was a 7-step process on how you find find a prospect, build rapport, qualify, and close a deal. And so ironically, in middle and high school, I'd tag along to these seminars and learn about sales process end to end. And my dad had a strong influence over me in terms of meritocracy and understanding human psychology. And through high school, was selling electronics at Super Target, trying to convince people to buy PlayStations and cameras and upsell best I could. And then following my high school sales career, I went door to door in Eastern Europe. And so going through university, I just sort of recognized, you know what, I have a real knack for this. I enjoy the human psychology of problem solving and solutions. And so that's kind of what put me on this trajectory to stay in sales.
That is amazing. I knew there was something unique about you. Now I know it's you were value selling, following a structured sales process in your teenage years. So my goodness, it is absolutely a part of your DNA. What a journey. And let's get into the meat of it. And I have a feeling I know what your game changer is going to be. If you had to boil it down to that one thing, that one initiative, that one best practice that changed the game for you, what would that be?
I think the consistent theme throughout my sales career has been focusing on value realization. So it didn't matter if it was B2C sales in residential neighborhoods where the benefits were different for maybe a child versus an adult, a man versus a woman, an elderly. They all had different things that appealed to them. So doing proper discovery to then figure out the benefits for their situation was critical to landing a sale. So I think when I finished the university and transitioned to business-to-business large enterprise sales, I quickly came to realize that the human psychology is consistent. Whether it's a CFO or a CDO wanting to buy something, that's the same person who I was selling to prior on their couch as they want a TV service. And so you need to make sure that you understand who are the key stakeholders that are involved in the decision-making process, because sometimes it might just be a husband and wife because changing TV service is easy. However, if I want to engage with a Fortune 500 retailer, I'm going to have to focus on a consensus sale where there's a lot of stakeholders with influence into the decision, and then figure out how to quantify the impact and the perceived ROI of my solution to the individual areas so that as they go through and you sort of look at this popularity contest or the bandwagon effect of who are they mostly all going to nod at, and it comes down to a vote more or less in these large enterprises, that you come out standing differentiated, because most competitors and or salespeople tend to get single threaded. But to do value realization effectively, it to be very multi-threaded and ensure you have a comprehensive readout of what matters most to the whole organization. Because if you can solve multiple things simultaneously, you can demand a higher ticket price, you can have a faster sales cycle, and you can have a higher conversion rate.
Value realization is not a new concept. I mean, heck, you were doing it in high school, right? So it's been around for a while. How have you translated what is a very, I think, very relevant concept to your teams? What have you done to kind of disseminate that knowledge to everybody else? Because that's right, the trick of the trade. I'm curious, what best practices have you used on the same?
Hire a few rock stars and they can sort of will their way to victory. They instinctively know what to do. They're creatures of habit and they can just play off of that to find and close deals. I think as you scale to a later stage pre-IPO company like Forder, you come to recognize the importance of standardization, because it's sort of the lowest common denominator of how can I simplify the message and the sales place to a place where now I can have it replicated across tens or hundreds of sales reps. Invest heavily into enablement, both in the place, so the content of who are the target personas, what are the sales plays we want to run at those different personas, what is the process from sales stage 1 to 7, what's the qualification framework that we want to standardize on? Really trying to take the learnings of your rockstar reps, package them up in a repeatable way, and make them available for us as a security company. There's a similar opportunity to decide whether you want to sell on fear of loss or desire for gain. If you sell based on fear of loss, you're typically going to be focused exclusively on a security persona or like a fraud prevention persona in our case, when you're selling to a lot of retailers. However, if you also orient yourself towards what's there to gain, you get access to and relevance with the chief digital officer, chief financial officer, because you can focus more on revenue maximization, improve customer experience, how do you increase conversion rates and let as many shoppers as possible shop on your website. And so I think it's important that you flesh out the different value drivers of make them more money, save them money, or keep them out of jail. And I think as a security company, if you can do all of those, it gets you access to increasing or an additional number of buying centers. It can also get you a much more compelling ROI story, because it's not just a bottom line savings play, but it's a top line growth story as well.
Makes a ton of sense. You know what I love about your statement too is it's clearly a company-wide initiative, right? This is not just salespeople sitting in the corner trying to go figure it out by themselves, although I think they are the tip of the spear, right? So you're starting with your best and brightest and learning from them, but then galvanizing the entire company together to change the messaging, change the perspective, all that, and then using that to drive, right? How do you, like you said, canonize this across the organization? I'm curious, did you see a change in your KPIs, right? In retention or I mean, give me a sense, like, have you seen a change? And I'm also curious, maybe a two-part question. How long do you think it takes before something like this actually really fits in the DNA of the organization? So you will see that change. What do you think that looks like?
So short answer is yes, we have seen improvements across our key KPIs. So as I look at the sales team, we're tracking things like ramp time to get on the board with the first deal, conversion rates, what X pipeline do they need for coverage to ensure that they can hit their quota? Because pretty common in our industries, you know, to have 3 to 5X. So if you can be closer to 3X, that's great, because that means you have a higher win rate. So you don't have to have as much top line coverage. Also average deal size. And so if we look at our key metrics there, plus the critical rep productivity metric of you ideally want to get at least half your sales team achieving their regular quotas to limit attrition and turnover. And then frankly, also to control your costs, because turnover is a super expensive proposition as you ramp new people. And so I think the investments we've made have paid off along those key metrics. Are we to where we want to be ultimately? Not yet. I mean, we're still working tweaks out, which is kind of to your second question. I think you knew the answer. You're just kind of leading question that it's a multi-year journey. I mean, I think it is a company transformation in the early days of focusing on value realization, because you're interviewing all the stakeholders across the company. The founders play a critical role in understanding what was the heritage of the solution, why are we doing it, how do we do it better than the alternatives. You're interviewing the support team to understand what our customers challenged with, the product team to understand like what are we building for and what's our direction and our vision for the future. And so when you're doing a command of the message type framework that you and I have gone through together, and you look at some of these industry standard frameworks of really trying to hone in on the value drivers and the how we do it and the how we do it better and answer the three whys, all these things, it is absolutely a cross-company collaboration. And I think there's enough demonstrated evidence at this point based on the success of these IPOs, whether you're looking at the Snowflakes of the world, the Octas of the world, the CrowdStrikes of the world, they've all followed a similar recipe, I think, of success. And so we're not trying to reinvent the wheel, but we're trying our hardest to remain rigorous and adherent to those best practices.
You brought up a couple of top points, and I want you to just speak a little bit more to this. So it's a multi-year journey. I think we all understand that. I think conceptually there is and agree with it. And conceptually there is absolutely a need for something like this. And you see the best and brightest companies. But you'll also find that there's a lot of, especially early stage founders, that may not be ready or willing or interested just yet in that transition to value selling, because they're beholden to the quarter, they're beholden to the current pipeline. And this transition takes a little bit of pain and suffering as well. So give some counsel to our audience. Assume that there's revenue leaders listening in and saying, hey, I want to go down this journey. How did you pitch this to your leadership in Forter and in past lives? What would you suggest they do as part of their pitch as well to cement this concept in their leadership's mind and get buy-in?
Admittedly, I think this is the most important sale a revenue leader will make, is the internal sale. I think there is a propensity for founders and early stage companies to underinvest in go-to-market, thinking that, hey, if my product is super legit, it'll sell itself, or the phone will just ring because this stuff is so amazing, and we'll just hire some rainmaker, natural all-star salespeople, and they can will their way to victory. It's a dangerous path to go down. I think in the early days, like Series A, Series B, and I've had the pleasure of being a part of some of those too, it's really about A/B testing. I would acknowledge, like, look, you can't really define a super repeatable, rigorous process when you don't even yet know how you're going to position yourself in the market. The early days are defined by pressure testing your message with your intended personas to see how it lands. And you sort of take your learnings from your losses and ideally get better to a place where you can pivot and drive those rates up. Here at Forter, similar to other places I've been, one of my initial priorities was in making the request to invest in sales process, sales qualification frameworks, different tools. Because as you know, given all your operational experience, the tool chain can be quite expensive as well as you add these fixed costs. Anytime you make an ask of the business, you have to be prepared to follow a similar process as you do externally. quarter over quarter, as you go to board meetings as a revenue leader, you have to be able to show the broader board team, here's the starting place on those key metrics we mentioned earlier in this call. Here's how they're trending quarter over quarter. And as you get positive sort of leading indicators and early success, it begets more investment because people are willing to further invest in places where they see some ROI coming. They don't want to keep throwing bad money after bad results or good money after bad results. And so I think that's where here I've had to focus very heavily on trying to be data-driven, not emotionally driven. I think as long as you continue to educate founders in the journey and you show them it's paying off, they'd be silly not to invest. If the deals are getting bigger, you're closing more deals, the growth is accelerating. So that's my biggest counsel, is just treat it like a natural sales process and don't cut corners. Otherwise, you won't get the answer you want.
Share a little bit. What would you articulate as those leading indicators?
What matters most in a high growth business is you want to have high velocity new logo acquisition. So how many new customers are we bringing on? What's the average sales cycle length within our segmentation model? So for us, we have commercial mid-market, I have enterprise, I have strategic. So let's pay attention to how we can condense those. And one can argue that if I have better enablement and I have better tools and I have just-in-time sort of manufacturing of the right content to the right person at the right time, these will help accelerate the deals as well as make them larger. We pay attention to win rates, just kind of understanding any worthwhile space is going to have a lot of competition. So you got to pay close attention to who you're typically seeing in every deal. Who are you beating? Who are you losing to periodically? And recalibrate that way.
Marcus, thank you. This is incredibly insightful. I know that our audience is going to get a ton of wisdom. I love to finish these conversations with a lightning round. Don't think too hard, just your gut reaction for each. Great leaders pick great companies. How did you pressure test that Forter was a company to go to?
So for me specifically, I look at who are the investors? Are these tier one venture capital firms? Are these successful board members? I look at how compelling the founder problem fit is. What's their origin story? Why are they trying to solve this problem? How's my chemistry with them as founders? I look at things like the total addressable market. I like disruptive plays where you've got a well-established legacy solution and it's ripe for disruption. And I want to span verticals and market segments, not be overly niche. I look at Glassdoor reviews just to get a sense for, is this a collaborative, enthusiastic, high energy environment? As I look at this particular opportunity at Forter, it checked all those boxes.
What would you share with others that are trying to make the transition to a leadership role from sales?
It's one of those inherent desires you need to have to help other people and to extend beyond yourself as far as your impact. During the pandemic and now, I guess, supposed recession we're in, people are going through some hard personal problems and challenges, right? There's a lot of emotional distress. There's a lot of anxiety. As a leader, you got to be prepared to kind of be a little bit of a therapist, show empathy for the adversity that your team is going through.
What's the biggest misconception about our discipline?
I just think there's commonly a perception of it's all about relationships. Like, no, that's part of it. But you better build a leak-proof enough business case that when it gets passed around 15 times, the people who don't know you still rubber stamp it, because you can't possibly get access to all the relevant stakeholders. Salespeople and revenue leaders have to be intelligent. They have to be thoughtful. They have to be analytical. They have to be prepared. You can't just ad hoc wing it all the time. And so that's what comes to mind for me.
What's your big prediction for the future of revenue?
One of the quotes I really like from Carl Eschenbach at Sequoia, who I've gotten to know well over the years, he's sort of a career mentor and represents the trajectory I'm trying to follow myself. He talks a lot about how execution is a differentiator, meaning we talk a lot about patents and IP and whose product is the best. And while that is important, there are countless examples in tech history of an inferior product winning the market because they simply out-executed the competition. And so I think when I think about revenue, leaders need to make sure that they recognize the potential impact execution can have. And that is, I think, demonstrated by all the things we've talked about throughout this podcast. There's a lot that goes into that. There's a lot of things you have to build and operationalize and run with for your teams. And if you fail to do that consistently, you'll get outflanked, I think.
Last one, and we'll make this one a fun one. If you weren't in revenue, what would you be doing?
An exotic car salesperson, because I love sports cars. And the thought of sitting at a Ferrari or an Aston Martin dealership and taking people for test drives all day feels pretty utopian to me.
Amazing. Count me in on the exotic car sales as well, by the way. So birds of the feather. Well, listen, Marcus, this was amazing. Really grateful to you for sharing your wisdom, your counsel on value selling, and just in general, getting a little bit more knowledge about your background. This was a fun conversation. Appreciate you.
Yeah, likewise. This is by far my most ambitious media project to date, Karen. So thank you for luring me out of my shell into the public domain. Wish you the best of luck with your future episodes, and it was a pleasure.
First of many. I'm Karan Singh, and this has been an excerpt of the Game Changers podcast. To listen to the complete episode, please be sure to follow Sapphire Ventures on LinkedIn and at Sapphire VC on Twitter. To get all the latest trends, best practices, and resources from revenue operations experts for startup growth, subscribe to our RevOps newsletter, info.sapphireventures.com/subscribe.
All opinions expressed by Sapphire and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions or views of Sapphire Ventures LLC. This podcast is produced solely for informational purposes and should not be construed as investment recommendation or otherwise relied upon as the basis for investment decisions.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Invisible Capital. For show notes and links to relevant reports and articles, visit pitchbook.com/podcast. I'm Alexander Davis. Until next time.
Invisible Capital is a production of PitchBook. Executive produced by Kai Yao. Hosted by Alexander Davis. Additional production and editing support by Jen Germain, Allison Cerrone, Brian Hoyson, Finley King, and Sam Steele. Cover art by Landon Early. Subscribe to Invisible Capital on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, visit pitchbook.com/podcast.